At Center Point Church, who are we? We are the people of God, called out from the world, chosen by the Father, redeemed by the Son, being transformed by the Spirit, and journeying together to the day when the rule of God covers the earth. Amen. It's good to be back together, and I trust you have come anticipating an opportunity to submit to the God of the Scriptures as we learn and study together. Loyalty. We love it. We are people who love loyalty. We really like it when we can be around other people who are, in fact, faithful to their commitments. We like to have friends who are loyal to us. We value a spouse who stays faithful. In fact, most of us are really happy if our favorite players on the Mavericks and the Rangers and the Cowboys will stay faithful and loyal to the team and not run away and chase other money. We like loyalty. When you think of animals that display loyalty, you might, like me, think about golden retrievers. They're just the most faithful, loyal dogs you can possibly have. They're just that, you know, I want to be with you all the time, kind of always trying to please their master, faithful creatures. I know I've had a couple of them at different times in my life, and I loved it. I could walk in the door, and there would be my big old golden retriever, and that tail would just start thump, 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 thump on the ground, and you knew that dog is happy to see me. Maybe nobody else in the world is happy to see me, but that dog is happy to see me. Give him a call, and he'd come running. Tell him to do something, and he would do it. That dog could even tell when I was sad, and he would come and try to cheer me up. Loyal, faithful dog. It was like he'd made a covenant to take care of his master. Of course, since we love loyalty, we ourselves also strive to be loyal. You know how it works. You sign a contract with an employer, and you seek to be loyal to that employer. You seek to do the things that you're supposed to do under the contract. Good for you. You have a girlfriend or a boyfriend, or a spouse, and you say, "Hey, I'm going to be loyal to you. I'm not going to let my affections be distracted somewhere else." Good for you. We have a country to which we take a pledge of allegiance, and we seek to be loyal to our country. We love loyalty. We love to be loyal. We want to be loyal. But there are times when we simply can't be loyal. Loyalty is always difficult. I'm not talking about those times. I'm talking about the times when there's a conflict in loyalty, and it's one or the other. You can't do both. Sometimes it happens in almost humorous ways. They're not humorous at the time, of course, but you look back later, you go, "Why? That was really a conflict." You know, it happens at Christmas time for a newly married couple. Christmas Day, are we going to her folks or are we going to his folks for Christmas? It's one or the other. You want to show loyalty to both, but can't do it at the same time. Or sometimes it becomes more difficult when it's the job that says, "You know, I really want to be loyal to my job, and it's going to demand these hours, but I want to be loyal to my family at the same time." And that conflict raises its head over and over, doesn't it? It's hard to be loyal, sometimes impossible to be loyal to both. Sometimes kids experience it this way. You know, they promise to hang out with a friend after school, maybe even help them with their homework, but they also promised mom to clean their room and do some things around the house, and it has to be done by 5 o'clock, and there's a stress over the loyalties. Can't do both at the same time. But the loyalty conflict becomes even more stressful when we recognize that it's a conflict between following our king to whom we pledged loyalty and some other allegiance that we have. I'll never forget, many, many years ago, I was working for a Christian employer. I hired on in good faith. I did exactly what I was supposed to be doing. And as I got into this job and spent weeks and then months and began to earn a pretty good paycheck, I began to realize that, you know what? What we were doing wasn't quite ethical. In fact, I felt we were deceiving our customers. It wasn't quite moral. And I was caught in a conflict. Whether I was going to keep my allegiance to King Jesus or my allegiance to this employer. It was hard. How do we respond when our allegiance to our God is tested? What do we do when our pledge to follow our King, Jesus himself, seems to be put in a test situation and it's one or the other? Now, obviously, not every conflict that we face in our allegiances involves an allegiance to God. But this is what I'm talking about this morning, is that occasion at time when clearly it's our allegiance to the Lord that's on trial. How do we respond? This morning, we're going to look at the story of a man in the Bible who, in fact, did have exactly that. In fact, it was an extreme test of his allegiance. A man who had to choose between family and fame and everything that the culture would have said that he should go versus a pledge of allegiance to God. We'll see how difficult that test was for him, and it will remind us a bit of how our allegiance can also be tested. And after we carefully examine the test itself, we'll look at his response and think about how we also ought to respond when our allegiance to God is tested. We're in 1 Samuel chapter 20, and I encourage you to turn there as we look at, first of all, how our allegiance to God will be tested. We're going to look at the story of David before he's king and his friend Jonathan. We're in 1 Samuel chapter 20, and we'll look initially at how our allegiance to God will be tested. And particularly, we'll look at Jonathan's allegiance to David, Jonathan's allegiance to God's king, and how that allegiance was, in fact, tested. We begin by looking at David, who has a problem. His problem is pretty simple. "Your father is trying to kill me," he says to Jonathan. 1 Samuel 20, note how David expresses himself in verses 1 and following. "Then David fled from Naioth at Ramah and went to Jonathan and asked, 'What have I done? What is my crime? How have I wronged your father that he is trying to kill me?' And of course, Jonathan can't believe it. He says, 'Never,' Jonathan replied. 'You are not going to die. Look, my father doesn't do anything great or small without letting me know. Why would he hide this from me? It isn't so.' But David took an oath and said, 'Your father knows very well that I have found favor in your eyes, and he has said to himself, quote, Jonathan must not know this or he will be grieved. Yet, as surely as the Lord lives and as you live, there is only a step between me and death.'" So we begin with this recognition that Jonathan is suddenly going to find himself as a man caught in the middle, a man whose allegiance to God and to God's program and to God's next king is going to be tested. Let's remember exactly who these people are. So you've got King David here. Well, he's not really king yet. He is king designate. He is king on the way. He is king anointed and acknowledged by only a few. You remember a while back we looked at a passage that showed how he had kind of a private ceremony where he was acknowledged as king. David has a good friend. His name is Jonathan. And Jonathan and David have already forged a covenant with one another, a determination that they would pledge allegiance to help each other. Jonathan gets it that God is in a process of taking David and getting him onto the throne that's occupied by our third character, Saul, the king, the one who has all the authority, the one who has all the power, the one who has all the privilege and the soldiers, and the one who's going nuts. You see, David has already had a couple of run-ins with King Saul. He's already been been playing his lyre, his harp, in order to calm Saul's nerves, and Saul has turned and hurled a spear at David to kill him. Jonathan has already gone in and calmed down his father and told him, you should not try to kill David. He's done nothing wrong. And Saul has said, okay, you're right. I won't kill him. He will not die. That's what he said. But then he chases David out, and David ends up running to his wife, Michal, who has to deliver him out through a window at night to escape the pursuit of Saul. And then David runs off to another town called Naioth Ramah, and Saul sends his messengers, his soldiers, and they end up prophesying as God protects him. And now we find David is running once again. He's running for his life. He's desperate. He has no army. He has no soldiers. All he can do is go to Jonathan. And he says to Jonathan, your father is trying to kill me. And so Jonathan realizes that he is in a position to do something for David, God's king, but it won't be easy. His allegiance will be tested. So in the verses that follow, we find a plan being proposed and developed by these two men. It's a plan of intrigue and espionage. It's going to involve a little spying. It's going to involve a little fact-finding, and then involve a pretty amazing climax. So we jump into the text again at verse 5, and we see David's plan is going to have Jonathan determine kind of his father's temperature. What's King Saul really got up his sleeve? Chapter 20, verse 5. So David said, look, tomorrow is the new moon feast, and I'm supposed to dine with the king. But let me go and hide in the field until the evening of the day after tomorrow. If your father misses me at all, tell him, David earnestly asked my permission to hurry to Bethlehem, his hometown, because an annual sacrifice is being made there for his whole clan. If he, that is Saul, if Saul says, very well, then your servant is safe. But if he loses his temper, you can be sure that he's determined to harm me. As for you, show, the NIV says, kindness, show loyal love to your servant, for you have brought him into a covenant with you before the Lord. If I am guilty, then kill me yourself. Why hand me over to your father? Never, Jonathan said. If I had the least inkling that my father was determined to harm you, wouldn't I tell you? So here we have David revealing his plan to Jonathan. Here's what we're going to do. There's a big feast coming up. I'm supposed to be there. I'm always there at this feast. But this year I'm going to hide in the field, and we will see how your father reacts. If he's calm and he's complimentary, we know everything's cool. But if he blows up, we know he was setting a trap for me, and he's going to kill me. Jonathan is caught in the middle. He is the litmus paper. He's the guy who's going to be the jury and really present the evidence before his father as well. But the interesting thing is, this isn't just a ruse. This is just not something to trick Saul. This is, in fact, a statement of covenant loyalty. This is a demonstration of allegiance. Did you notice the words that were used back there in verse 8? I slowed down just a bit when I read it earlier, but let me draw your attention back to verse 8 again. David says to Jonathan, as for you, show literally loyal love. Show covenant loyalty to your servant, for you've brought him into covenant with you, and it's a covenant before the Lord. If I'm guilty, then kill me yourself and hand me over to your father. What David is saying to Jonathan is, look, I'm not just asking you to do this as a buddy. I'm asking you to do this on the basis of a covenant that we have struck with God, and this is how God works, with covenant loyalty. And so, Jonathan's loyalty will be tested. Well, Jonathan makes a pledge, and in the verses that follow, verses 10 through 23, and we're not going to read all of them, he pledges his covenant loyalty back to David, and he says, hey, I'll go in and do what you said. I'm going to go find Father's intentions, and I will come back and tell you personally. I'll figure out Dad's temperature at the feast. But in return, Jonathan also wanted from David a pledge of his covenant loyalty, that this demonstration of loyal love would not simply be one way, it would be two ways. Jonathan says that there in verses 14 and following. Look back in at the text. Verse 14, but Jonathan speaking, show me loyal love like the Lord's loyal love as long as I live, so that I may not be killed. And do not ever cut off your kindness from my family, not even when the Lord has cut off every one of David's enemies from the face of the earth. Do you understand what David's doing, what Jonathan's doing? He's saying to David, look, I'm going to take this great risk for you. Would you bind yourself in covenant loyalty also to me, so that if I'm killed, my descendants will be preserved by you? You see, Jonathan recognizes he's putting himself and his family at risk, because to become an enemy of his father, to become an enemy of the king, is probably going to mean that perhaps his own father would kill him. But he's still the heir of the king himself, so it may be that David and David's army would end up killing Jonathan. Jonathan is in a no-win situation. He's going to be perceived as a threat to the throne, whether he stays with his father or he goes with David. So on the basis of his own covenant loyalty to this one who's going to become king by God's plan, Jonathan asks for David to express a similar covenant loyalty back to him. And David does. So the covenant is going to be so strong that it will go both ways. It will be helpful to both men. Stakes are high for Jonathan, aren't they? Things could go very wrong here. He could lose his father. He could lose his pathway to the throne. He could be kicked out of town, ashamed in front of the whole nation. This could land him in exile. The risks of demonstrating allegiance to this king designate, the risks are high. But he does it. And the stage was set so that Jonathan would execute his plan to determine Saul's intentions. And the question now is, what will happen next? They actually make an agreement, and Jonathan says to David, look, here's how this is going to work. I'm going to go in and test my father, and I'll figure out what he's like, and then we'll go out in this field, and out there in the field, you hide behind that rock, and I'm going to shoot three arrows, and I'll yell at a boy who will come with me, and if you are to come closer, I'll say to the boy, come, the arrows are closer, and if you're to run away, I'll tell him, go, run, the arrows are further, go, and you take that as our code. And in that code, you'll know whether it's safe to return or you ought to go back. Whew, what a story. Hollywood couldn't dream this one up. So the test is on. The story proceeds in verse 24 when David doesn't come to the feast. And we see, indeed, that Saul explodes. Chapter 20, verse 24. So David hid in the field, and when the new moon feast came, the king sat down to eat. He sat in his customary place by the wall opposite Jonathan, and Abner sat next to Saul, but David's place was empty. And you can just imagine that Saul kept looking at that chair. He's not here. He's not here. Saul said nothing that day, for he thought, well, something must have happened to David to make him ceremonially unclean. Surely he's unclean. He's going to take care of that. Verse 27,
But the next day, the second day of the month, David's place was empty again. And Saul said to his son Jonathan, "Why hasn't the son of Jesse come to the meal either yesterday or today?" Notice he doesn't call him David. He doesn't call him, "Why has my son-in-law come?" No terms of endearment here. He gives an insulting term to David by referring to him as the son of his father. Jonathan answered, "David earnestly asked me for permission to go to Bethlehem. He said, 'Let me go because our family is deserving of sacrifice in the town, and my brother has ordered me to be there. If I found favor in your eyes, let me get away to see my brothers.' This is why he's not come to the king's table." Saul's anger flared up at Jonathan, and he said to him, "You son of a perverse and rebellious woman, you are a stupid traitor," is basically what he says. "Don't I know that you have sided with the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of the mother who bore you? As long as the son of Jesse lives on this earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Now send someone to bring him to me, for he must die." The words of Saul rang through the chamber, that because what he says to his son is that his son is not worthy to be called his son, that his son is a traitor, that the son is not going to be welcomed with him, and that his son ought to conspire with him to bring about the execution of David. Now, Jonathan knows what his father's intentions are. It's very clear. What does he do? Does he maintain his allegiance to David? In which case he will lose his pathway to the throne. In which case he will lose a relationship with his father. In which case he will live as an exile from the palace. Or should he maintain his allegiance to his family, his father, his kingdom? Maybe initially we might think that our tests are not quite exactly the same as Jonathan's, and yet I would suggest to you that they are. That we face days and points in time when our allegiances to God and to his program and to his king are put to the test. And we will have to make tough decisions. Our loyalty would be put on trial. Sometimes it can come through employment. You know, it sneaks up on you. You take a job, and it seems to be a really good job, and it pays well, and it starts off really smoothly, and you're committed to being a good employee, and you will serve your master. But then you discover there's ethical problems, and customers are being cheated. And perhaps you find that the products are harmful to people, or they're harmful to the environment. And the employer is demanding that you work overtime. And the employer is demanding that you work on Sundays so you can't meet with God's people. He's taking you away from church. And then you realize that this employment has gotten to the point where it's testing my allegiance to God. And there's conflict. How do you respond? Your king says, live with honesty. Promote life, not death. Serve your family, serve his church. And this employer is now presenting a test of your allegiance. How do you respond? Or it could be a test from your family. You know, you married someone that you thought would be a good mate, a companion for life's journey, and someone with whom you'd have children and raise them and enjoy life's pathway together. But now that spouse is pulling you in the opposite direction, away from King Jesus, keeping you from church, keeping you from God's program, leading you to have a life that's much more directed toward evil and sucking you into a lifestyle that is clearly opposite of King Jesus. You have a pledge to your spouse, but you have a pledge to the Lord. How do you respond? It's a test. terrible test. Parents can test your allegiance to God. They can push you away from the king and pressure you to, say, pursue a certain college major or a certain kind of career. Maybe there will be things that will cause you great conflict because you can't follow King Jesus in the way that you're sure he would have you go. Conflict. How do you respond? You see, my friends, our allegiance will be tested. When we live in a world that has King Sauls running about, we will be tested. How to respond? Jonathan got it right. Let's turn to the text, and what we're going to find is that Jonathan clings to his covenant with the king. Jonathan clings to his covenant with King David, the appointed king. He is indeed going to persevere in this desire to show faithfulness to David. Verse 33, chapter 20. Jonathan got up from the table in fierce anger. But here's the first, well, actually, let's go back to 32. Sorry. Verse 32 shows his first response. Why should he be put to death? What has he done? Jonathan asked his father. But Saul hurled his spear at him to kill him. And Jonathan knew then that his father intended to kill David. This first response of David to cling to this covenant, of Jonathan to cling to the covenant with David, is simply to defend David before his father. He says, "Father, you do not have reason to kill him." That didn't work very well. His father tried to kill him. Second response, Jonathan gets up from the table in fierce anger, and he doesn't eat because he was grieved at his father's shameful treatment of David. David basically says, I will not eat with you. I will not have fellowship with you. He recognizes that he cannot have fellowship with Saul, his father, and also fulfill his allegiance to David. Can't be done. And then he runs to the field to tell David. In the morning, verse 35, Jonathan went out to the field for his meeting with David. He had a small boy with him, and he said to the boy, run and find the arrows I shoot. As the boy ran, he shot an arrow beyond him. When the boy came to the place where Jonathan's arrow had fallen, Jonathan called out after him, isn't the arrow beyond you? Then he shouted, hurry, go quickly, don't stop. The boy picked up the arrow and returned to his master. The boy knew nothing at all about this, only Jonathan and David knew. Then Jonathan gave his weapons to the boy and said, go, carry them back to town. And after the boy had gone, David got up from the south side of the stone, and he came and he bowed before Jonathan three times with his face to the ground. Then they kissed each other and wept together, but David wept the most. And Jonathan said to David, go in peace, for we have sworn, really we've sworn together with each other in the name of the Lord, saying, the Lord is witness between you and me and between your descendants and my descendants forever. And David left, and Jonathan went back to the town. Jonathan kept his covenant with David. He did it in three different ways. He talks to his father. He leaves his father. He warns David. And can you picture the scene where he and David get together alone in that field, and there's a bowing of David and an embrace of one another and a weeping and a kissing in order to say to each other, we will cling to this covenant. What a misreading of this text to look at it as simple friendship. This is not just friendship. What a misreading of this text to look at it as a justification for homosexuality. It is not that. There's affection here for certain, and there is emotion here. But this is a picture of two men in covenant loyalty to one another who are saying, we will weep and we will cry because we recognize that our pathway is going to go take us away from people we love and away from our country. And yet, we're in this together, and they're doing the right thing. Jonathan will cling to his covenant with the king. That's his response. When our allegiance is tested, how should we respond? Like Jonathan, We have a king to whom we are committed. We are in covenant relationship with him. And he is persecuted by the evil powers of this world. And our call this morning is to respond by clinging to our covenant that we've made with him. It is indeed to make good on our allegiance. It is to persevere in our pledge that we have made to King Jesus. So that employer who turns out to be immoral, what are you going to do? He deceives customers and maybe prevents you to worship. This might be the test of your allegiance. How do you respond? Cling to your covenant with the Lord. There's no simple answer. Persevere in your pledge. It might mean that you have to confront that employer. It might mean that you have to quit. There will be risk. But we cling to our covenant with our King. Or how about that spouse that brings a conflict in your loyalties to the King, and she or he is taking you away from the Lord and causing a great deal of problem? It may be that you'll find yourself in a place where you have to confront that spouse. This is not a call to run away and divorce. It is a call to say, look, no matter what, we must recognize that the priority is to cling to our covenant with Jesus and pursue him in the midst of a difficult challenge. For some of us, we are going to face a conflict with our country. It may be in hiring practices. It may be in prayer practices. It may be in proclamation practices about where we can proclaim the gospel and where we can't. It may be in taxing practices about supporting abortion and other things that we would see are against the scripture. And we will come to the point where we say it's either loyalty to the government or loyalty to the King. Not an easy decision. But what this text says is cling to your covenant with the King. Persevere in your pledge to him. Some of you might say, you know, I don't even know if I've ever made that kind of commitment to the King. You say, Vic, you're pushing me way beyond what I ever thought possible. I've just been kind of enjoying church, sitting around these nice people, singing some good songs, enjoying some friendship. My friend, I trust that God will alert you fully to the wonder of being in covenant relationship with him. For our King indeed binds himself to us in covenant, and he looks for a covenant response from you, one of commitment. I don't know. In the end, I wonder whether a golden retriever is the best picture of covenant faithfulness. They make me really happy, that's for sure. They remind me of loyalty and extreme allegiance, that nothing could be held back. My friend, this morning, may God challenge us to have an undying loyalty to our King, regardless of the cost. And so, our Father, we acknowledge we are called to this extreme allegiance to you, to your program, to your plan, to your King. And Father, it frightens us because we know that a call to covenant loyal to you is often a call to exclusively follow King Jesus. And we are frail. I ask, Father, that you will give us boldness like Jonathan himself, courage to maintain our commitment to you. Help us, we pray, for Jesus' sake. Amen.